We're literally standing next to three elephants.
Yeah.
Who are sort of snacking
and
in
he's
a
walking to a
sugarcane area.
She's there. That's my first time ever touching an elephant.
Wow.
Just now.
I'm just going to leave this all in, Derek.
So great.
Is this your elephant?
Probably not.
Coffee and Elephants podcast?
Welcome to the Coffee and Elephants podcast. This is Rolf Potts, Derek Sivers.
Don't forget to smash that like button.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today's episode is an in-the-field report from a 7-day, 100-kilometer walk and talk that I took across northern Thailand last December. This event, which in previous years was held in places like England and Japan and Spain and China, was organized by futurist and former Deviate podcast guest Kevin Kelly in tandem with writer-photographer Craig Maud. Walk and talks are defined as movable salons that mix long-distance hiking and informal conversation during the day with an intensive, in-depth, one-topic-per-night Jeffersonian conversation over dinner each evening. My Thailand walk and talk cohort included a dozen dynamic thinkers, scholars, journalists, technologists, and authors, some of whom are quite well-known, and I consider it a big honor just to have been invited. I interviewed about half of our cohort members on the final 2 days of our 7-day hike, including author, entrepreneur, and CD Baby founder Derek Sivers, whose voice you heard in the teaser to this episode. Derek will eventually be the subject of his own episode later this season, as will Wired Magazine co-founder Jane Metcalf. Today's episode focuses on the walk and talk itself and features in-the-field conversations with organizer Kevin Kelly, as well as designer Liz Danzico, ethnographer Sylvia Littner, journalist Daniel Pink, and co-organizer Craig Maud. More about all these people, including essays about the walk and talk written by them and others in our Thailand cohort, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. The walk and talk is a concept that is more or less designed to be stolen and replicated in diverse and varied parts of the world by people who can appreciate its ethos. I fully intend to design my own walk and talk someday, both in my home state of Kansas and points beyond. That's part of the reason why I decided to do these interviews and create this episode. All of the interviews took place during or just after a walk over the course of a week-long hike that took us from the highest point in Thailand to the old city center of Chiang Mai. Note that I didn't record the more intense philosophical conversations that took place over dinner each evening and aren't meant to be recorded. The conversations you'll hear in this episode were recorded during the day when we were hiking or just finished hiking. Sometimes you'll hear that we're short of breath when we're hiking uphill. Oftentimes you'll hear dogs and cars or random groups of Thai mountain trail road racers. We talk a lot about what the walk and talk was like for us and how it's conducive to thinking and creativity. We talk about how to maximize conversation in an age of distraction and how walking and talking for days at a time can intensify human connections. We talk about how one might go about creating their own walk and talk, from how many people to invite to how far you should walk each day. The social dynamic was fluid and unstructured, and by the time I conducted these interviews, I already knew everyone in the group pretty well. We don't just talk about walking and talking, of course. We also talk about the stray dog that walked along with us for the last 4 days. We talk about the recent migration of Chinese creatives to rural places and how urban design affects the way we experience cities and what makes Thailand feel different from other parts of Asia. Feel free to look at the show notes for time codes and themes and resource links for each person I talk to. My first interview of this episode took place in the middle of the final day of the hike when I asked Kevin Kelly to introduce himself and spell out the philosophy and methodology behind a walk and talk. Let's listen in.
So, who are you?
My name is Kevin Kelly. I am senior maverick at Wired Magazine, and I package ideas.
So what are we doing right now?
We are on a week walk with a small group of people who are spending the day chatting to each other, shoulder to shoulder, enjoying northern Thailand, where we are right at the moment. Headed to lodging tonight in the city of Chiang Mai, where we'll have our last dinner together and one long conversation.
So we've been walking. This is day 7 of a journey where every day we walk from place to place. You said you're an idea guy. So what's the idea behind walk and talk?
The idea is, how do you maximize a conversation among new friends? And the device, the technique that we have evolved towards is to walk along a linear path for a week. And everybody gets a chance to have a long conversation, a deep conversation with everybody else. We're about 10, 12 people. And then that makes the evening conversation, which is usually one conversation and one topic, very deep, because you've done all the chit-chat and getting to know talk during the day. So it's a way of really intensifying and maximizing conversations as a way of making human connection.
Where did this idea come from?
It came from my experience of inviting people who were available to join me in my own travels, where we started to have conversations at night. And it came from some walks I did with Craig, where we figured out that if you had luggage forwarding during the day and you only carry day packs, which is what we're doing right now, that that liberation and coming not to a tent, but coming to a like a hotel room where you take a shower, that kind of luxury really facilitated a focus on being able to have conversation during the day as well. And so we evolved this kind of pattern and found places in the world where we could have 7 walks of maybe 10 miles a day and expect to get lodging and a meal and a shower at the end of the day and only carry day packs during the day. And as we sought those kind of places out, we started inviting people to join us, and that's sort of the origin.
How do you choose the people who come?
So we look for several things. One is this is invite, but we're often sometimes inviting people that we know about rather than know. And we try to find people who are good travelers, flexible, because what travel entails is being making the most of whatever happens. We can't control everything. And are good conversationalists, who we might want to hear what they have to say about for a whole week.
What about walking, functionally and philosophically, makes this distinct? You know, as opposed to, you know, riding bicycles or...
Right. There is something very wonderful and strange and mysterious about what happens when you are walking and talking, which is there's something about the motion of walking. I think that's very conducive to both ideas and conversation, where you can empty your mind and open your mind at the same time. You can empty your mind of existing ideas and let go of what you have to normally do, and you can also, you're much more receptive, it seems to me, to new ideas. And I don't really know the psychology of that, but that's, I don't know how much science there is in that, but I think that's what I feel. I feel that the rhythm, we're kind of engineered biologically to walk. And something happens. I know that when I'm trying to write, I often will pace, because that motion I find conducive to thinking.
So for people who might be listening and want to create their own walk and talks, what, given your experience in having done this for many years now, is the optimal number, size of the group and criterion for picking them, number of days, distance? How does one create their own walk and talk?
Yeah, so you can do a walk and talk for a single day. But invite a bunch of friends, have a long walk, you know, maybe 20 kilometers, and you can invite some friends and you schedule a place for lunch, but you don't carry anything, and you could try out this basic premise, and you could expand that overnight. We have found that there's a correlation between the number of people present and the number of days. Meaning that the more people present, the more days you need, because optimally, you actually do want to have enough time that you could say you had a deep conversation with everybody present during the week. And so we always want to invite as many people as possible, but the limit to the size of the group is actually how many people can you get at one table at dinner and have one conversation. It's actually a physical limit where if you get more than 10 people, it becomes really hard to have a table, that find a table every night that's big enough for 10 people
to talk about,
to have a conversation about one topic and where everybody can hear and participate. So that is sort of the limit. And if you have 10 people, then you need at least a week. You need at least 7 days to make sure that everybody has significant time with everybody else, one-to-one.
When you were talking about keeping to one topic in a table of 10 people, it occurred to me that you're sort of the enforcer. You're the person who needs to make sure that
this has to be moderated. This is not something that happens completely ad hoc. You have to have a very strong moderator who is going to keep the conversation going and focused. Where's Chris? You want to interrupt if somebody's dominating. You want to make sure, and actually maybe deliberately make sure, that everybody speaks and participates.
Prompt the shy people.
Yeah.
You mentioned also a second ago, you said, where's Chris? Is it fair to say he's our logistics person?
Yeah. So in this case, we can talk about this. Come over here in the shade.
Okay.
We can talk about this, but the logistics, there are, in this group, this walk in Thailand, it was engineered by someone who lived near, and we're doing a walk that's not, hasn't been done before. He sort of pioneered this route, and he figured it out by living locally and made all the arrangements.
Do you always have a person who does this?
Well, Chris actually did it for us in China, and Craig has done some in Japan, but we've also gone other places where we have taken existing routes and found an outfitter to do all that for us at a very nominal fee. You tell them when you want to go and how many people and pay them the money, and they don't charge much more than what it would cost just to book the lodging yourself. And they're going to forward the luggage and the whole thing. Wait, where's Chris?
He's...
He went to the toilet, I think.
Oh. Well, are we not going to wait for him? Hey. Craig?
Well, why don't we wait for him?
Let's wait.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I thought he was... Is he not here?
No.
So this is a little bit of the cat herding aspect of the...
Navigation's always an issue. These days, a lot of places, the ones I just mentioned, including, we can give you a GPS route, which you can put on your phone instead of the paper maps. And that becomes part of the challenge and the fun. You're going to get lost. I like getting lost. I think that's fine.
And we've had some detours.
We had detours. And that's part of travel. You have to kind of expect the unexpected.
Well, in this situation, as we've been telling Thais what we've been doing, they're surprised. They don't know people walking
right.
7 days across the north of Thailand.
Right.
Chris, who we're waiting for right now, actually got lost while scouting the trip and slept in the jungle one night.
Yeah.
We're getting off-road a little bit here. I think I might wrap with you, Kevin.
Okay.
I'm going to take that mic and maybe talk to someone else here.
Okay.
Thank you for that.
Sure.
Hi. Who am I? Liz Danzico. I am, at the moment, walker of Northern Thailand. By day, by night, catching up on my job as designer and educator and dog lover. That's who I am.
We have a dog who's joined us.
That's right. In fact, my biography that's out there in the world says something like part-time designer, part-time educator, full-time dog owner.
Right.
And I have been smitten by this dog who's joined us on this walk probably about 50 kilometers ago. And when we stopped for the night at an elephant camp, we picked up now a friend for a few days who's been following us high and low, and
it's more like he picked us up. It's like,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, we wake up in the morning and he's still there. We traveled by river at one point, or by, yeah, small
and
river.
And he jumped on the raft.
Yeah, jumped on the raft. And when that was not suitable for him, he went to the land and swam. He's different modalities of transportation. It's quite impressive.
And we started calling him TD for Thai dog, but apparently in Thai, TD means good thing, I think.
Oh.
So TD, the good thing, has been our companion for multiple days now.
That's right. Both in dog and in the fortune that we've had. It has been a good thing, this walk. As we're talking about this, we're traversing layers of
right, the path got quite narrow, and
yeah.
Because I used wired microphones, we can't separate too far apart, so it's almost like we're in some movie about two people who escape from prison, and they're handcuffed together, and they have to run in tandem across the jungle.
Right, so there's a metaphor somewhere.
Right. Well, let's talk about your interest in and involvement in this walk. How did you get involved, and what made you want to do the walk, and what have you been experiencing here?
I received an invitation before, so I had been invited to a different walk and was not able to do it. So this was my second invitation, I believe. I have a whole series of decision-making frameworks about when to say yes to something.
Okay.
And one of them is, if you feel like it will make you kind of bigger and expand your range rather than diminish you and deplete you.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly feel a little depleted energy-wise.
Okay.
My feet. But in every other way, I feel energized and expanded.
Mm-hmm.
I usually feel that way when I do something that I haven't done before.
Hmm.
And I look for opportunities personally and professionally such that every new thing I take on has some element of me being either afraid of it or having never experienced it before. And ideally, it has both.
Hmm.
And then I know that it's the right, there's no right, but then it's a good step forward. So that was my criteria for coming on the walk.
Mm-hmm.
And I very much appreciate not having any technology. I have my actual camera out today.
A non-camera, non-phone camera.
Non-phone camera, as they're called,
right.
Out. And sort of, I've almost not touched a phone or a laptop all week.
What's that been like? Has it been nice, or is it anxious about that?
I love it. I could do it for weeks more at a time. I actually do look for opportunities to do that as well. I think it brings clarity and makes me appreciate, I don't know about other ones, but it makes me appreciate all the more having that opportunity to re-engage. Makes each interaction more meaningful. mm-hmm. you go back to it. And I think this amount of time, 7 days, allows me to have meaningful conversations with every person more than once. Mm-hmm. So it's just enough time to have had those. And so I've taken that away. And I feel a sense of clarity about things that I've been wrestling with. That idea that when you walk away from a problem or a piece of work that you're working on, mm-hmm. you immediately see the answer or the clarity.
Yeah.
So I think I've benefited from that as well. Just sort of being away from it and hearing and thinking about other people's work and problems and, you know, mm-hmm. things that are going on in other people's world. So I've taken away clarity about my own life and my work and feel quite inspired to do more.
Can you see yourself replicating this with your own cohort of people in the future?
I could see it. So until the pandemic, every year I would go on a reading vacation by myself. Mm-hmm. And I would take 5 books mm-hmm. and go to a place I'd never been before. And you know, I would read most of the day or take some of the day and go explore. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I would bring people or not, but I could see replicating it either with a cohort of people or just by myself. Hmm. I could see doing it with my dog.
Right.
If my dog counts as another person.
Right.
And just me and my dog setting off for 5 days. I think that's the order. I could see first doing it with the dog, second doing it alone, and third with the cohort. And maybe doing it in that rotation once a year. And I think all those things are necessary, you know. For me, I process information in all those ways.
Right.
So, yeah, I have it. Is it fair to ask you any questions? Can I?
Sure, yeah.
Have
please.
You, would you, could you see yourself replicating this?
Yes, although I will admit that before we even started, I was thinking about how to replicate this. Because I already am a walker. I'm married a walker. I sort of want to reinvigorate my relationship with where I live, which is a rural place. Oh, by the way, there's some joggers, some Thai joggers with walking sticks walking through here.
Pretty advanced outfits.
Yeah. I think we've walked into some sort of mountaineering road race.
Yep, we're at the finish line.
Yeah, we're very close to the finish line. I often think of ways to reinvigorate my relationship with where I live, which is Kansas, and so I've been trying to figure out if I can design a walk and talk in Kansas, and I think I might be able to. And of course, there are multiple places where this could be done, places that I return to quite often, Paris, where I teach a class every year, Colorado, where my wife has a cabin. But sort of the counterintuitiveness of Kansas as a walking scape sounds like it could be fun. And so, yeah, I like the idea of this being a thing, you know, just a normalized things for Americans, perhaps, as a counter to other things, other ways you could spend a week off from work.
Mm.
I was in Kenya. I was hanging out with the hiking club this summer, and I was asking the leaders of the hiking club about what it was like. And when we got into the topic of competition, I said, "Are there other hiking clubs that also have clients?" And they said, "Yes, but our real competition is Netflix, right?"
Yeah.
Just the idea that if you're going to spend a week off from work in some way or another, there's many perfectly wonderful ways to do it, but there's something pretty special about what we've been doing this week, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I participated in a global walk that was all done via video chat recently.
Mm-hmm.
It was maybe last fall, kind of on the heels of everyone returning post-pandemic to the world. And it happened at the same time all over the world, anyone could participate. But it was, some people got together in person, and it happened once globally. There was something beautiful about knowing that everyone was doing it at the same time, but also, of course, different time zones, different parts of the world. And I have thought about doing that. Part of my job is running this global team across multiple time zones all over the world. And I have thought about different ways of engaging that team all over the world. And I could see doing something that's not just, you know, getting the group all together, but kind of engaging them that way and people, cohorts together across time zones, not feeling, to your point about screens being kind of the competition, maybe incorporating the screen in some way.
Well, I love the idea of this sort of thing as a creative act, you know, that we're taking Kevin and Craig's ritual, activity, and maybe using this as a thought experiment to think about other options of spending quality time in the world. Mm. It's funny, we appear to be in the middle of a mountain race. A lot of people with walking sticks and actually the same footwear as us. A lot of people literally have the same shoes, the same walking shoes as us.
We
sort of walked into a mountain race where everyone, their legs are very soiled. They've obviously been running through dust, and a lot of them are wearing these Hoka walking shoes, trekking shoes, that a lot of us are owning as well. So it's interesting, the texture of this day is so much different than our earlier, more rural days. We're almost sort of in a suburban Chiang Mai area now, as opposed to our more rural areas before.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts before I unmic you and track down somebody else about what's been going on this week and how it fits and what you've been getting from it?
I appreciate that it's inspired people to create other things. So the fact that you're creating a new thing layered on top of this thing already in the midst of it is quite inspiring. And so I'm sort of thinking about all the photographs that people have been posting and what other things will emerge from this. And it makes me think of all the things that are being created right around us, like the this life is raw material for so much that happens kind of in real time as we're walking through it. And it was quite inspiring.
My name is Silvia Lindner. I'm usually at the University of Michigan, where I teach in the School of Information and also in the Science and Technology Studies program. Usually around this time of the year, I would actually hang out in China,
okay,
where most of my research takes place. But a lot of the people who I've been following over the last few years in China made their way here to Chiang Mai. And so when Dan and I got the invitation to join the walk and talk, I was really excited because I thought I could both do the walk and talk and meet interesting people, but also follow some of these young Chinese people who have moved from China to Chiang Mai. So that's why I'm here.
Now, I know that some of your research is of interest to me because I'm a global guy who lives in a rural place and I'm trying to find ways to interact with that. You've actually done research with Chinese people who have moved from the city to more rural areas. Can you talk about that a little bit?
While I was, you know, in the U.S. during the pandemic, I stayed in touch with people from my prior research site, so people who had been starting these early hacker spaces, people in entrepreneurship, and as I was talking with them online, on WeChat, a lot of them were telling me that they had somehow moved into partnerships with agriculture or rural life. And so I decided to apply for a fellowship to study this phenomenon. Immediately when I returned, I began traveling to some of these rural places. One of them was Jiangxi province, but also Guangdong province, outside of the industrial parts of the province, and then later on also Yunnan. And what I noticed was that these, what I found there were young people experimenting with what they would call alternative ways of living. And these weren't just isolated experiments. So Jiangxi, Guangdong, and Yunnan are very different provinces. but these young people understand themselves as part of a broader network, a part of a broader project, and they deliberately leave the big cities. There's a Chinese word that describes a common phenomenon in the big Chinese cities of overwork and exhaustion. It's called neijuan. In English, it refers to involution. And it's part of a broader vernacular now of how people, young and old, in Chinese cities talk about that they are under a lot of pressure, that their life is all about work, and that they're exhausted, and that life seems almost meaningless. So these young people who I met in rural parts of China said, we don't want to live like that. And instead of, you know, going abroad or going to another big city, they choose China's countryside. And I just want to emphasize how radical that is, because since China opened up in the 1980s, the city was always the place to be cosmopolitan, to be future-oriented, right?
Urbanizing like crazy.
Exactly, exactly. Because being in the countryside was associated with being backwards. People wanted to move away from agricultural life or maybe a family dependency on rural production. And so this is a really drastic shift in a value system, right? Where for these young people, actually going to rural China is what it means to be cosmopolitan. They think of going to a rural place to a village of like 40 houses and starting something new there. They think of that as something that is global and cosmopolitan and forward-looking. And so that was maybe one of the most surprising things to me, what I found in that research.
Yeah, no, there's so many parallels. Probably the topic of a completely separate interview, just because my own interest in sort of that reverse brain drain into rural areas is something that I think about a lot. But let's talk about this walk. How did you end up involved with it, with the walk and talk?
So Dan got the invitation from Kevin and asked me if I was interested in joining. And I had known of Kevin Kelly since my early days in grad school. Kevin was actually invited to one of my research sites in Shenzhen. The maker and hacker enthusiasts at that time, this was around 2015 and 16, were such a fan of Kevin that they invited him to be a big speaker. And
so in China, Kevin has a lot of fans in China,
yes,
right?
A lot of fans in China, yeah. So when Dan asked me to join the walk and talk, I was very intrigued by the kind of group that Kevin would gather for an engagement with a part of Southeast Asia that I'd been to before. But not in a kind of mixed capacity of professional intellectual debate and engagement with the country. So I was very intrigued and said yes right away, basically.
Listeners will note now that we're back on a road with cars. So the sonic texture is a little bit different, but I think this should be comprehensible. And so how is this experience? This is day 7 of a 7-day experience. What has it been like for you?
So as we talked about earlier, I'm from Austria, where there's a lot of mountains. I grew up in a town called Salzburg, which is right next to the Alps. So since I was a small kid, I went hiking. So it's kind of part of who I am, is to be in nature and go hiking. And it's something I've done quite a bit in China as well, and also in America. And so it's been both similar. I think this walk and talk has been similar to my past experience, but also different, because I've never done something like a walk and talk with people who I hadn't met before. So I think for me, the most unique aspect of this is the being in nature while also being intellectually engaged throughout.
Lunch, we're gonna be going down there for lunch in just a second.
What's here?
We're doing a bathroom break.
A bathroom break, okay.
Okay.
We won't go into the bathroom.
Okay.
Craig, where are we right now? Do you know?
Close to lunch.
Close to lunch. There's a lot of, there's joss sticks. There's joss sticks being burned. There's a sort of a temple type scenario here. All right, well, we can grab a chair here, grab a bench. So are there, you talked about the intellectual aspect of this. Are there specific intellectual topics that you responded to? Things that have surprised you that you didn't expect to talk about?
Oh, something fell.
Oh, that's my bottle.
Yeah. I think the thing that has been most remarkable for me is actually how open people are to talk about quite personal topics. So I think I've had conversations with people about their professional practices and how they got into their jobs and what they're reading and what motivates them, but then also very personal conversations around what has been hard in people's lives. And I think the tone for that maybe was set early with one of the conversations we had during the first dinner. But I really appreciated how open and vulnerable people are. And I was wondering throughout the whole experience so far, if maybe the walking is in part what enables this, that it's not just an intellectual engagement with one another. It's also a very personal engagement with one another, even though many of us have just met. And I've really enjoyed that. It's not always easy to get people to be vulnerable. And for me, vulnerability, even though it might sound like a contradiction, is a strength. I'm a big fan of the anthropologist Ruth Behar's work. She has this book called The Vulnerable Observer. And this has been very meaningful to me because I practice ethnographic research, and part of ethnographic research is that we describe and observe other cultures and convey them for people who might be not as familiar with them. But Ruth Behar in The Vulnerable Observer wrote about the importance of also bringing in the personal, making yourself vulnerable as part of the ethnographic storytelling, and how that isn't compromising the ethnographic project, but actually the subjective vulnerable few can offer lenses into cultures that we don't really have if it's a more rational, kind of distant.
Makes it less one way too.
Yes, exactly. And so I feel like, and I feel like people, all of us have sort of indirectly, without maybe knowing it, practiced this kind of vulnerability.
What personal topics were raised the first night that stood out to you?
I think it was the first two nights. So the second night, I think we talked about what is home.
Oh, yeah.
And that really resonated with people, I think, because many of us are between places or between cultures or between a past experience in a particular place and other experiences, and so so that this question of what is home and who is home and where is home, I think allowed people to be quite sort of open, and also this became also a topic about relationships and family and what that means, and sort of the many ways family can be. And I think the first night, what was our topic? I think our topic was
I interpreted it as
how we arrived somewhere.
I interpreted it as first half of life, second half of life. But how do you change as you grow older? I'm not literally describing what it was, but I'm describing how I interpreted it. Like, once you've become successful, how do you continue to make decisions to underscore, to continue to live richly?
And so I think in part what has been really wonderful is the sort of intergenerational conversations about this. So some of these topics, I recently went through the tenure process and have transitioned from many years of a quite precarious sort of life as a PhD student to then being in, you know, this sort of career track of an assistant professor, which can be quite stressful. And then recently got tenure, and then I often questioned myself, is this really what I wanted? Is this who I am? Is this what I want to do? And so hearing other people sort of reflect on how they themselves went through stages like that, or shifted their work, or shifted their where they wanted to live, that was personally meaningful for me to hear across different generations in this group.
Is this something that you would do again or create for yourself?
I was thinking about that.
I think it's inspired me to think about how to do something like this in my own professional context. Mm-hmm. I have a dear friend who has been a collaborator for over 10 years. She's a philosopher working at NYU Shanghai. Her name is Anna Greenspan. And Anna has this practice of walking in Shanghai's parks while we are brainstorming. We've been writing together, and sometimes she would just get up and say, let's go to the park. It will help us to think differently.
Interesting.
And that's always been true. It has always helped us think differently. And so I was thinking, what could be a hybrid of these two models? I think having like the 7-day long trip is something that's maybe not always possible to do. Not everyone has time to do that, but how can we create sort of like smaller versions of that as part of our everyday practice? Mm-hmm. And so some of the things that I've been doing in my teaching is actually take students out of the classroom, where we do kind of like walking in the city. You know, I've done excursions through Detroit, which is very close to Ann Arbor, and experience other neighborhoods outside of the classroom. So. And doing something like that, not only for students, but for the scholars, might be really fun. So that's something I've been thinking about while we were here together. How might this apply also to other genres and professions? And
any other thoughts about this week?
Well, can I ask you a question?
Sure, yeah.
So you and I have talked a lot about sort of engagements with the non-dominant culture or living in places that are maybe alternatives to the status quo. And the status quo could mean like an urban center that's associated with, this is where creativity happens, and or a place where everyone wants to build a career. So I'd be curious to hear how this trip in Southeast Asia here in Thailand in particular has made you rethink your own choices of being in a place that's maybe an alternative.
I think it's a great way of describing it, because sometimes when you fall into the rural-urban binary, that comes with its own set of prescriptions and assumptions. Whereas if it's just seen as alternative, you know, as an alternative way to live a creative life, or as an alternative way to live day-to-day life in maybe a place that has more space or that costs less, then in a sense, choosing to be rural then becomes an alternate lifestyle. You know, alternate lifestyles often happen within cities, but when you pull it out of cities, then you have a different way of looking at it. And on this trip, I think, as we've been going through very rural parts of Thailand, but I think as much as anything, one thing about a communitas-style experience that we're having is that it's a little bit hard to have the inquiry be about the place where we are. I mean, we've made a dog friend, and we've had a lot of great food, and we've met some people, some of whom are sort of flabbergasted that we're walking 7 days across urban Thailand. But it feels like just like talking to you about how Chinese people have, especially younger generations, have approached rural living as an alternative has helped me sort of clarify that aspect of my own life. I think I came into this experience with fixations like sort of how to live a creative life in a rural America, you know, or how to deal with aging parents, you know, late life quality of life, things like that. And so it's interesting how it's just sort of melded in. Like I had no idea or a little idea coming in that this is something that you could speak to, but it's become a part of the conversation that you and I have been having over the course of the last week. So I guess this week could be walking as a creative act, you know, that not really sure. We sort of think we know what we're getting when we come into it, but then if we can stay open, then it can affect our thinking in many ways. That some may be planned, some may be unplanned. Some might be relevant to right now. Some might be not be relevant to our way of thinking or living it for a few years. We have to sit on it for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the sitting with it is a good way of putting it, because sometimes it takes a while to digest certain experiences, and it will only come to us later, right?
It's interesting. Sitting with it is a metaphor. You have to sit on this for a while. Could you walk on it, right? You know, we could sit on our walking experience, or we could walk some more on our walking experience and just sort of process what we're doing here.
There's something to what you just said, which is about the sort of opportunity to also engage. So this is something that I would want to do if I did something like this again, to slow down a little bit.
Okay.
And have, because we walked a lot, we talked a lot, but it would be really nice to have moments of break and slowdown where we also engage with specific sites and people.
Oh,
and
right, yeah.
This is what you, I thought, what you were just saying earlier. So, I think that would be fun.
Yeah, no, as a travel writer, like it would be difficult to report a travel story this week because there's no, because it's been about communitas, it's been about the group.
Yeah.
And we've hung out with elephants, we've practiced our Thai, we've seen a lot of very specific parts of Northern Thailand, but we're so committed to the conversations that we can't really commit ourselves to the place. So it would be a bad setting in which to report a travel story, even as it's a great setting in which to sort of explore our own lives and our own intellectual interests and things like that.
Yeah.
Well, cool. I'll call it good.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for talking with me.
My name is Daniel Pink, and I'm sitting here in Chiang Mai, Thailand, next to you, Rolf. I, for the last 20 years, have written books that stand at the intersection of business and science and kind of human performance. And so I've covered topics ranging from the science of timing, science of sales and persuasion, the emotion of regret, the changing skills necessary in a world where work is getting outsourced and automated. I wrote a graphic novel. I wrote a book about the rise of free agents. I wrote a book, what else? I'm missing something, but you get the idea.
So walk and talk, it involves a culmination dinner, but it also involves sort of randomly socializing
on the trail. Yeah, yeah, good point. Yep.
And that might be something that my listeners would be curious about, because in a way, you ruin the point of the exercise if you just bond with one person and talk with them the whole time.
Interesting, yeah.
So for you, how did this work? How did the social dynamic while we were walking work?
The social dynamic to me was pretty organic. And I think that's a function of size. Huh. I think it's a function of size and a function of proximity. If this were a larger group, I can see things possibly grouping into factions. Huh. But here, there weren't enough people for factions,
right.
Of any kind. And so I was surprised at how organically it all happened. So, I might be walking, or I or anybody else might be walking, say, 2 or 3 kilometers. I would walk 2 kilometers sometimes totally by myself, just walking and chilling. And then I would just happen to fall into somebody else, or I'd catch up to somebody, or they would catch up to me. Or what often happened to me is that I'd eavesdrop on somebody and I'd sort of chime in, and then suddenly the three of us are talking for 4 kilometers or 5 kilometers, and then we have a break, and then when you break, you have a drink of water, and you start chatting with somebody else, and then you start walking with him or her for 4 or 5 kilometers. And it was all very organic. What was your experience about that? I didn't find myself saying, oh, I need to talk to X, or oh, I haven't talked to Y, or anything like that.
Yeah, well, I had, as an introvert, I think I was not the only introvert on
No,
the trip.
I think most people were introverts.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's sort of a self-consciousness to introversion in activities that are named things like walk and talk. Like if you're walking alone for a spell, you feel like, oh, I'm failing. I need to be.
So you would have been more comfortable with a walk and walk.
No, I think.
Or a walk and think.
Introverts love structured activity. You're sort of knowing the rules of
activity. Oh, that's a good point. I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah. And it was interesting because there was a kind of loose, tight structure to this, in that we did have these dinner conversations, and they were about one topic and one conversation. That's very structured. Now, I'm okay with structure. I think it's a good point, because I happen to like structure for these kinds of things. The actual walks were, the conversations on the walks were completely unstructured.
Right. Yeah, and I was saying I wasn't a self-conscious introvert because I didn't want to talk to people. I was a self-conscious introvert because I wanted to talk to people and I wasn't.
Okay.
And so I thought, oh, do I need to find somebody to talk to? How many miles, how far should I walk alone? Because you made the observation that sometimes you would walk several kilometers by yourself. And I think eventually I made peace with that.
Yeah, that was cool. It's not like, I mean, I saw people walking by themselves and I was like, oh my God, so-and-so is walking by herself. This is ridiculous. No. There wasn't. People were pretty chill. I think you're right that I think most people on the trip were more introverted than extroverted. Mm. I think that helped.
I also had to.
We had like a hardcore gladhander, gregarious person, I think we would have left him or her in the river.
Right. No, yeah, I think those super extroverts who just need to be talking all the time.
Yeah, oh, God.
I think it would leave us 10 times as exhausted by the time we arrived.
God, just thinking about it is exhausting.
Yeah. Yeah, another dynamic I noticed on the walk is that we sort of had permission to sort of end a conversation and drift to another one.
Exactly.
Because
I agree.
And I didn't realize this. I realized it a little bit later on that, like, I would be talking to Jane for 45 minutes, and then everybody would stop for a drink. And I didn't need to say, talk to you later, Jane.
No, not
nice
at all.
Talking to you.
Not at all. No, it was very organic. That's the thing. I was curious about, you know, how the groups of conversations came about, sort of how the groups came about, how they formed, how they disassembled, how they reformed in new ways. Mm. You know, because there are a lot of potential combinations of conversations when you have 12 people.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're doing the math at home, I think the calculation is 12 factorial, which is a pretty big number.
Yeah. No, it feels like nobody really monopolized my time in particular. Like, I felt like I got some good walking time with everybody.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that happened organically. It's interesting. I don't have a really good explanation for it. I keep using that word organically just because I can't figure out what the underlying rules were. It just seemed pretty natural how that happened.
Yeah. What do you think you got out of the week? What are you going to remember about it?
I don't know. I think I have to reflect on it. That's one reason I wanted to have this. I'm glad to have this conversation. To me, it's. I don't know. It's probably one of those experiences where the sense making is going to occur afterwards. Hmm. That the sense making is not going to occur. You know, hey, I'm done walking and lugging my. We just finished 100 kilometers, and now I'm lugging my bag to the room. Let me tell you what it all means. I just don't think it's that kind of thing.
Clothes are still soaked with sweat.
Yeah, yeah. I don't even think like today, on the day that I'm going back home, I don't know what it means. Hmm. It's probably the kind of thing where I will reflect on it over time and get something out of it.
How does it feel having done several?
It feels good. I mean, and the consistency actually, I think, speaks to the quality and the workingness of the whole endeavor. You know, it's like we've done basically six.
Okay.
And they've all been, you know, equally spectacular. And like, and we were talking this morning about how the first day feels so long ago.
Right.
You know, and that density of emotion and experience and physicality, you know, is present in all of them. Mm-hmm. There's not a single one of these where you get to the end and you go, oh, that didn't feel so bad, or that was pretty short, mm-hmm. you know, or oh, I didn't connect with anyone. You know, it's like everyone by the end is pretty much hugging and, you know, crying and, bonds have formed in all of them. So it feels like the format itself is a success, and you could kind of, I often say, that sort of jokingly, that the root of the walk is almost irrelevant because you're so ensorcelled by all the people around you and the conversations that oftentimes you don't even see what you're walking by.
Well, let's make this a part of the conversation because I want this to be included.
Sure.
That was a sort of preamble, but I'd like to make this, I think that's important. So tell me who you are and what you're doing in Thailand.
I'm Craig Maude, and I was co-leading a big long walk with Kevin Kelly.
And what do you do for a living?
I'm a writer and photographer.
Okay. What makes a walk and talk a walk and talk?
I think a walk and talk has a couple qualities. One, it's a curated group of people, so it's not random. It's not just an open call and then whoever gets there first comes. So Kevin and I spend quite a bit of time. Actually, that's probably the most onerous part of the walk and talk is like figuring out who to invite, doing the invites, following up, all that stuff. Number one is that it has to be a great group of people, you know, and the qualities of the people kind of fundamentally are just have to be nice and doing interesting work. That's kind of it. Those are the only real qualifications. You have to be kind, you have to be patient. As far as we can tell, sometimes we've never met the people, but we kind of try to suss that out. So that's the main quality. And then secondly, if possible, have the walk be contiguous. So it's one continuous walk where you're not hopping on trains or getting in cars or boats or whatever at the end of each day to go to the next place. So you walk from inn to inn to inn to inn. And ideally it should be supported in the sense that your luggage is being forwarded ahead just to open up the accessibility of it. If you have to have everyone carry all of their luggage, that means certain people couldn't do the walk, for example. We try to keep the walk level of difficulty such that anyone from 20 to 75 could do it. So these aren't like Swiss Alps, you know, mountain climbing walks. We tried, you know, we did Cotswolds, which is extremely gentle on the body, you know, just rolling hills and flatness and sheep and beautiful, you know, kind of vistas out over grass. And then every night having a great focused conversation, a single topic conversation, and trying to pull everyone into it. I think that's really critical. And I think part of the reason why you finish a walk and talk and feel kind of all this bonding is that you've heard from everyone, you've really listened to everyone, because Kevin usually moderates and he will keep track of who has or hasn't contributed. If someone's over-contributing, he'll often try to tamp that down a little bit and try to pull out the voices of the people who've been a little more quiet. So by the end, you sort of know where everyone stands as humans, in a way. And so I think that should be also one of the goals of the walk and talk, is by the end, you really know the people you've been walking with pretty intimately, maybe more intimately than most of their friends in some cases.
It sounds to me like there can't be a commercial version of a walk and talk because of the curation aspect, that you can't just have a glossy brochure that says walk and talk, all members welcome. It sounds like maybe curation, choosing the group is key, or am I wrong?
For sure, choosing the group is key. Also, once you commercialize it, people can complain. So we can't do, you know, like this walk in Thailand was a first of its kind. We don't really know what it's going to be like. We don't know what the lodging is going to be like. Kind of have a general idea. But as soon as it becomes transactional financially, and people think, well, I've paid a bunch of money for this, and I deserve to get X, Y, and Z, that really changes the dynamic too. So everyone in the group is on equal footing. There's no power dynamic around who's running it, or who's paid, who's getting paid, anything like that. And so all of the suffering is shared equally. So it's like, you know, if you end up at a weird, you know, hut that, you know, doesn't have a shower, it's like everyone just has to suffer through that. And, you know, I think it minimizes complaints and it just keeps things honest in a way.
And it probably keeps things cheap. It was a pretty tight margin, right? Like nobody's making money off of this.
No one's making money. And yeah, I mean, it's shockingly cheap. How cheap it is to produce these things.
Right, and Thailand is an inexpensive country, but how was the Cotswolds in Japan, for example?
Even almost, you know, maybe 30% more expensive. I forget what we even paid for Thailand, but like I think the Cotswolds was 1,800 maybe.
Okay.
For the week.
Mm-hmm.
Japan was 1,500.
This was 1,300 or 1,200.
I mean, you can do a week of walking almost anywhere in the world for less than $2,000.
Okay.
For sure. But yeah. That doesn't include food, but...
Mm-hmm. So what would be the process if someone listening to this thought, okay, I want to organize my own walk and talk? How does one go about doing that?
We got to find a walk with infrastructure. So we don't like camping because it requires just work on the tail end of the walk, and we really want the focus to be on talking. So talking while walking, and then when you get to the place, being able to just recover, because the talking itself takes up, you know, I think people underestimate how much energy talking and really listening takes. Mm. And so we want to make sure there's recovery time baked into every afternoon. And so, for example, if we arrive somewhere and then had to set up camp, it would just be too much. So we think that having built-in infrastructure is critical. And so countries like England are really good at that. Spain, the Camino, for example, is just a natural pick. Swiss Alps, we haven't done that, but it might be too arduous in terms of up and down, but they have a really great hut infrastructure, and I think they have bag forwarding. Ireland would probably be great. Scotland would probably be great. Japan is fabulous. You can hire local companies like Walk Japan, and they'll book everything for you, and they'll take care of luggage forwarding. So I think that's critical. We've tried to set one up in the States, but the U.S. just doesn't have a history of walking and with walking infrastructure. So we haven't been able to do that. If anyone has a good idea of a great way to do a walk and talk in the States, we're all ears. I think we were kind of brainstorming. You set up an RV caravan. Mm. You hire an RV caravan that goes ahead. I think that gets significantly more expensive pretty quickly.
Right.
But you'd have like a chef and the RVs, and then you arrive, and then you have the camp already set up, kind of a roving camp. But, and you know, Southeast Asia kind of works. Like on this one, we were able to string it together. So you can get creative sometimes, and if you, even if there isn't an official walk, you can find lodging and infrastructure to make it work.
Yeah, if any listeners in the U.S. know of how they might string a route together, let me know. Because I've been daydreaming about one in Kansas, but it's still, there's nothing, it's hard to stretch anything shorter than 20 miles together with adequate lodging and infrastructure. And that's not even the West, that's the Midwest.
So. Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess that's another good point, is the distances really need to be modulated. So, and this depends on heat as well. I think if it's like 31, if it's over 30 degrees Celsius, you should really keep the days at a max of 15 kilometers. Otherwise, 15 to 20 in sort of temperate weather seems to be a pretty good distance. And the reason why you don't want it to be too short or too long is because there is something really satisfying about feeling just the sense of having covered distance. And then, you know, like on this walk, at the end we ended up doing 100 kilometers, almost on the nose, over 7 days. So that just feels good. That feels like it, you know, it's like we accomplished something truly physical. And I think that there's a nice symbiosis between that, having used your body and then every night use your mind. And so you finish the days like completely full and completely used up in a good way.
Yeah, I think there's this an important achievement appreciation distinction to keep in mind, because I think some people might think, you hike 10K? You know, I run 10K.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
But it's really not about the achievement so much. I mean, there is something very satisfying about, you know, walking from the highest point in Thailand down to Chiang Mai, and a lot of Thais are like, what? You can do that?
Yeah.
But at the same time, it wasn't too physically ambitious, and it feels like there's a point at which too much physical effort might cancel out the social aspect in the evening.
For sure, and keeping it inclusive, too. So it's not like only, you know, Rich Roll can do these walks, you know.
Right. Hardcore fitness people.
Also, keep in mind that when you're walking with a group of 10 people, it's much slower. The pace is much slower than if you're doing it alone or just the two of us. You know, like Derek and I one morning took off together, and I think we were 90 minutes ahead of the group at the first rest point. You know,
it was just 90?
I think so, yeah. Okay. We were sitting in a cafe for at least an hour before everyone else showed up.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, 10K, 10, 15, 20K isn't that much if it's just two of you. But with 10 people, there's kind of like a, almost like a, you know, elasticity where, you know, some people are going slower and then, you know, catching up, and then people want to take breaks, and lots of breaks are good. Being able to engage with the locals are good. Stopping by farms, stopping by cafes, you know, just kind of having a non-crushing pace is critical. And really the walk, you got to remember, is the purpose of it is like a platform for the talking. It's not just about doing the physical act. That's kind of like dessert, the fact that we did 100K. But it's really about catalyzing conversations while moving.
You walk a lot, you write a lot about walking. Do you have sort of a philosophy of walking or an approach to what walking can do for one?
Yeah, most of my walking is in Japan on these historical routes. And I often do them with the internet basically turned off, no music, no podcasts. No social media, no news. I'll use apps and programs like Freedom to block a whole swath of the internet during my walk. And it's to just become hyper-present, essentially, to kind of cultivate boredom in order to instigate engaging with the locals. To like, because you end up getting so bored, you just want to talk to anyone, any kind of stimulation. So I find that I'm much more willing to like walk into a field and talk to a farmer if I've just been bored for 5 hours, you know, walking alone. So it becomes a platform for that, kind of understanding a place in a way that I think is almost impossible to do otherwise. If you're biking, you probably wouldn't stop. If you had music or if you were running, that's a different kind of engagement. But to be kind of in the middle of nowhere walking, people sort of take that seriously in a strange way. They kind of perk up, they kind of respect the fact, especially if you say like, hey, I walked from Tokyo and I'm 3 weeks in. You know, that shows us a kind of rigor of trying to understand their place. And I think that makes folks vulnerable and curious in a way that other activities, other ways of moving through a country doesn't.
It feels like there's an extent to which this walk and talk experience is undocumentable. I mean, I've been interviewing some people on the podcast, and people have taken photos and different notes. There's different creative angles to this, and we have the collective creative angle, but even sitting here, I have trouble distinguishing, you know, what we discussed each night. I have a big picture sense of things, but it feels like this is truly one of those experiences that is about the experience, that is about the interactions, and documenting it. And I'm a writer. I've been doing this, you know, since before you had the option of doing it in social media. That's an instinct, but it feels like that's almost a prescription of this, is that between the walking and the talking, there's no sense to properly document it, so you just have to live it. Does that sound fair?
For sure. I mean, I just think physics makes it impossible to document in a way, right? We're just expending so much energy every day on the engaging and listening. And I keep saying listening because that really is a high energy activity. I think we underplay how active you have to be a good listener. I've tried in the past to do basically what you're doing, what you did on this walk. So I brought lav mics, and every day I would interview someone for an hour. I did that in Spain, and it was just too much, you know. And those interviews are just on my hard drive somewhere. We never made anything with them, and we tried to record some of the conversations at night, but that also changes the. I just think the vulnerability of it, you know, it's like you're not going to be as vulnerable. Mm. You're not going to be as honest to a certain degree if the mics are on. It's not because you're saying crazy things, but it's just because you're saying personal things. So you're saying, you know, stuff that you may have never shared before, you know, in some cases.
So there's an implied audience beyond the tent.
Yeah,
the table.
Yeah. So I think when you kind of create that cone of trust, that's critical to getting a walk and talk, to the emotional place that it really begins to sing.
What do you get out of walk and talks?
It's just purely about getting close to what I consider great archetypes, rubbing shoulders with people who I feel like are living great lives, inspiring lives, good lives, honest, good faith engagement with the world lives. And it's one thing to, like, you know, I can listen to your podcast and I can listen to 10 of your podcasts. I can kind of get a sense of who you are, but it's totally different to spend 24 hours a day, essentially, 18 hours a day, shoulder by shoulder, sitting next to each other, sharing every meal, talking for 2-3 hours in the afternoon while walking. That, for me at least, allows me to believe in the goodness of a person. It allows me to model internally the goodness of a person, or the rigor of a person. Like Derek getting up every morning and saying he was writing for 2 hours a day. Like, that's wild to me. I
didn't realize he did that. That's impressive.
Yeah. It was, so even just hearing that and then watching him kind of interact and engage and seeing how his mind kind of moves, and then you realize, like, oh, now I know why this guy's been as prolific as he's been. And you can kind of see the positive pathologies that have led to that in a way, while you're walking, while you're spending a week together, that's impossible otherwise. And so, you know, like I've talked about on the walk and in my essays and stuff, I feel like I kind of left my high school or whatever with a certain set of deficits, and I've been trying to fill that in through just being close to good people and understanding, modeling, having them model like what good faith engagement with the world looks like and feels like.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including summaries and essays about the Thailand walk and talk written by the various people who participated, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And of course, if you have walk and talk ideas or questions or suggestions, feel free to email me at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.